This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
What is going on in Syria, and what should we do about that? We will talk about it tonight in general, in detail. You'll get all boned up on Syria. We have Victoria Coates joining us to talk about that. We have culture war stuff. Can they just get rid of the 14th Amendment? All that and more coming up on I'm Right. Let's talk about Syria, shall we? And let me go ahead and get you prepared for what you're about to see here on I'm Right. We're going to have a bit of a general discussion about foreign policy and humanitarian aid. I'll be handling that. But if you're one of these people dying for details, you want to know who are the factions, who are we rooting for, who are we rooting against, Victoria Coates is going to join us in just a few minutes to break down details. So we'll give you the 30,000-foot view, and we'll give you the up-close and personal. Now, let's discuss, first of all, you want to know where a large percentage of the cops who die, where they die, how they die? This will come back to Syria and everything else, but police officers are obviously killed sometimes in the line of duty, sadly, and it happens a lot at night, pull people over at night, it happens, of course. Of course, it happens in all the scenes you see in the movies where you're kicking in the door of a drug dealer. These things happen. But if you know any cops, most cops will tell you the most dangerous situation they've ever faced in their careers, and oftentimes the one that kills cops, are domestic disputes. Isn't that interesting? All day long, they are catching bank robbers and murderers and gangbangers. But the thing that kills cops a large percentage of the time is a domestic dispute. Now, why is it? This will come back to foreign policy. Stay with me. Why is that? Well, you are an outsider, and you, as a cop, are called to a situation. And you're called to a situation where there's a husband, there's a wife, and there's a problem. You have not been there for the entire problem, and there's no way, no matter how much you listen, you can understand the entire problem. They get the problem, and they're fighting. You are the outsider stepping in, and you step into a volatile, the most volatile situation, because they both reside in the house. They know the history. They know what happened that night, and there are emotions flying all over the place, the most extreme emotions, because they know each other so well. So they know each other well, they're tearing each other's hair out, and then you, the outsider, step in to try to control the situation. And that is the guy who gets shot a lot in the line of duty. It is. Now, I want you to think about that when it comes to foreign policy, you see. What I just said, it's just kind of a more modern, more easy to understand way that the foreign fathers understood, founding fathers understood foreign policy, you see. It's not that they were not interested in what happened across the globe. They knew what happened across the globe mattered then and now. Of course it mattered. It always mattered. It will always matter. It's not that they didn't care if France was squaring off with England. Of course they cared. But what they did was they studied the entire course of human history. And what they found was it's really, really for the best if you mind your own business. It's really for the best if you don't look across the pond and see some conflict and say to yourself, wow, we should get involved there. We should definitely try to control things there. That is a recipe to get you burnt. Why would you go dive into the middle of somebody else's problem? Now, what I just said makes total sense, I'm sure, to you. Most normal people it makes total sense to. So why doesn't it make sense to our politicians, Republican and Democrat, I should know? Why? Why are they so against just minding their own business? Well, there are a few different reasons, and all of them are awful. First and foremost, they don't ever have to die. And their children never have to die. We used to have foreign policy in this country, and the politicians and generals and admirals who would carry out that foreign policy either they themselves would be put in harm's way or had been put in harm's way, or their children would. I'm talking on the front lines. We have Teddy Roosevelt's son dying in World War II on the front lines, dying. But that doesn't happen anymore. It's your kid who has to die. It's my kid who has to die. Their kids are, they're off at Harvard or onto an internship with Senator Idiot's office. So that's a big reason. Another reason is it's hugely, hugely financially beneficial. If someone else has to die and no one I know has to die, and I get some extra campaign donations out of this, the defense industry will love if we get mixed up in this. Well, that's always a good thing. Maybe my brother's cousin's uncle needs a job. Hey, Boeing is hiring. Boeing, you want to hook my guy up? Don't forget, I cook things off in Syria. There's a huge vested financial interest in all this. And if we're being honest, lastly, it makes you sound tough, like a leader, and patriotic to go on adventures outside of your border. And this is not unique to our country. Everyone understood historically, politicians understood, if your approval ratings are low, raise up an army and go fight some foreigners. It makes you look patriotic. It makes you look like a leader. The people of your nation will think higher of you. Julius Caesar, when he was assassinated, was actually plotting a foreign campaign that was totally unnecessary. Why? He was getting less popular domestically. Hey, gather up an army. Let's go fight somebody. And it's really gross when you understand the motivations behind it all. And when you sit and you think that people in North Carolina, it's freezing right now, some are still without homes, living in tents, and the president of the United States of America couldn't wait to run to the microphone to announce we're going to hand out some aid to Syria.
With a new constitution, a new government that serves all Syrians, and this process will be determined by the Syrian people themselves. And the United States will do whatever we can to support them, including through humanitarian relief to help restore Syria after more than a decade of war and generations of brutality by the Assad family.
We're going to rebuild Syria for them? While Americans are still suffering. I mean, they're suffering in Hawaii still from that fire. You do remember the fire, right? East Palestine, North Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, Virginia, suffering. President of the United States of America, though, he doesn't get to look like a brave foreign adventurer by handing out some goodies to North Carolina. You know, swooping into Syria and rebuild everything, look like $1 million, of course. And they're going to use a bunch of words that create emotions inside of us. Keep this in mind. The propaganda war is always coming for you, coming for me. ISIS, I hate ISIS, you hate ISIS. If you boil down to what those scumbags did, you could make an argument they're the most evil human beings who ever lived. And so when they announced that we're dropping airstrikes on people, of course, ISIS was brought up.
We will help stability, ensure stability in eastern Syria, protecting any personnel, our personnel, against any threats, and will remain our mission against ISIS will be maintained, including the security of detention facilities where ISIS fighters are being held as prisoners. We're clear-eyed about the fact that ISIS will try to take advantage of any vacuum to reestablish its capabilities and to create a safe haven. We will not let that happen. In fact, just today, U.S. forces conducted a dozen of precision strikes, airstrikes, within Syria, targeting ISIS camps and ISIS operatives.
Okay. Let's hope that's what it was. Let's remember that you also can't believe anything these people say. They lie about everything all the time, especially when it comes to confusing foreign conflicts. What's actually going on in Syria? Who were the fighters? Whatever, but Let's take him at his word, which we probably shouldn't do, the guy who lied about everything. Let's say it was about ISIS. Okay, fine. But why are we already involved? Why do we always feel the need to get involved? Every fight should not be our fight. Every fight cannot be our fight. And this is not, look, this is not isolated to Joe Biden. I was going to read you a long statement from Lindsey Graham, one of these neocon Republican types, but I'm not even going to bother reading the whole thing. It's just more confusion. Let's get involved. We have to ramp things up. Let's get bipartisan. Let's get involved. How long are we going to do this? How long? Remember George Bush? Remember this?
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. I want Americans and all the world to know that coalition forces will make every effort to spare innocent civilians from harm. A campaign on the harsh terrain of a nation as large as California could be longer and more difficult than some predict. We have no ambition in Iraq except to remove a threat and restore control of that country to its own people.
How'd that work? You know what? I changed my mind. I think I will read you this Lindsey Graham quote just because it's so long, it's so convoluted. Tell me if you think the United States government can do even a fraction of what I'm about to lay out that they say here without completely mucking the whole thing up in a million different ways and costing lives and God knows how much money. Here's what Lindsey Graham had to say. This sounds very straightforward. I appreciate the airstrikes against ISIS targets in Syria, but it will not be enough. We have to ensure that roughly 50,000 ISIS prisoners in northeast Syria are being primarily held by Kurdish forces are not released. We should not allow the Kurdish forces who helped us destroy ISIS on President Trump's watch be threatened by Turkey or radical Islamists who've taken over Syria. Turkey has legitimate concerns regarding different groups that reside in northeastern Syria. But if there's a conflict between Turkey and Syrian Democratic Forces or Turkey attacked, oh my gosh. You see what I mean? It's not simple, it's not straightforward, and we shouldn't be there. And the morons who run America's foreign policy couldn't possibly pull this off even if they wanted to. For the first time in my adult life, can we just let them have at it? This is a domestic dispute, yet another one we don't have to show up at and get involved. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. If you want more detail, what are the factions, the forces, the strategies at work? Victoria Coates knows all about this area, all about what's going on. And for you nerds who need the details, actually, I want the details too. I'm a nerd too. We're going to go to Victoria in a moment. Before we do that, let me tell you about your cell phone service and why it's garbage. I mean, I'm sure Verizon's working fine for you, but the problem is you're paying too much and you're supporting a company who hates you. AT&T despises you. T-Mobile might actually be the worst of them. They hate you, they hate your values, they hate your culture, and you don't have to have that. It's Christmas time. Why don't you switch cell phone services, save a pile of money, even get a new phone if you want it. If you want to keep your phone, keep your number, you can. You want a new phone, new number? After all, Christmas season, Pure Talk has great deals on all the newest stuff. Same 5G network, you're not sacrificing service. Save money, same service, patriotic company. What? Why wouldn't you switch? PureTalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. All right, so that was the general American foreign policy talk, but I know you want some details. What are the factions, the forces, the history? What should we be doing? And I'm here to tell you that I'm not the one you should talk to. Victoria Coates is the one you should talk to, VP of Foreign Policy at the wonderful Heritage Foundation. She is fantastic. Victoria, this shouldn't be hard for you, being as how we've met before. I want you to imagine I have the mind of a small child, and I don't know anything about Syria and the factions and the forces, and should I be cheering? Should I be crying? Where are we going? So I'm just going to hand the show over to you. Tell me what is going on and what we should be doing about it.
Well, Jesse, good to be with you. And I think in this case, we're going to embrace the and. We should be both cheering okay. and crying. On the one hand, we have the horrible Bashar al-Assad. We've had 50 years of Assad, brutal Assad rule in Syria. All your listeners and viewers need to know is that at the end, what Assad did in his horrible prison was turn off all the electricity and the ventilation. So literally there are people, prisoners, political prisoners asphyxiating as we speak because they can't get in to release them. That's what kind of people we're dealing with here. But unfortunately, on the other hand, the so-called rebels are not what you would call freedom fighters. This is not George Washington and the founding fathers by any stretch of the imagination. These folks are alums of both Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The leader of them, Al-Jabbat Golani, has a $10 million rewards for justice price tag on his head. has committed horrendous atrocities, having been radicalized by both the Second Intifada and 9/11 attacks. And so really at this point, you know, we have on the one hand folks like the Assads who are backed by Iran and Russia. We have the so-called rebels who are backed by Turkey. None of this is good in any way. And I think the Israelis have it 100% right. They are taking additional high ground around their northern border to be able to keep an eye on these people, because just today, the militants posted a video in which they said they were coming first for Jerusalem and then they were coming for the holy shrines in Saudi Arabia. That's who they're after.
Okay, that is such a great place for us to begin. Let's start with the rebels. We'll come back to Assad because actually I'm fascinated about that. You mentioned one couple things stuck out to me. That's Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Now, I know, as many people watching knows, those two groups are not exactly best buds. I find that interesting. So they're what, united in Syria? That's one. Two, you mentioned their leader has a $10 million bounty on his head. People with that kind of bounty on their head do not live very long. How long has this guy been out here with that kind of bounty?
Well, it's interesting. These factions don't generally get along, and we have the new group HTS, which are the descendants of the old group Jabhat al-Nusra, both specially designated terrorist groups. These tend to be Sunni militant groups, and they generally hate each other. But the one thing they hate more, Jesse, is the United States and Israel, and increasingly Saudi Arabia. And so, you know, that's what unites them, and they sort of have come together here. And so, you know, that's why this is such an enormous degree of concern, is these folks can become wildly violent. And, you know, again, unconfirmed, but videos of them harassing Christians today, you know, it may be just a very short period of time before, you know, they start committing atrocities of their own against the minorities in Syria, which means that President Biden, who was patting himself all on the back, almost got a crick in his neck yesterday. He was doing it so enthusiastically about how he had brought peace to Syria. That may look pretty disingenuous in about 2 days' time.
Okay, let's focus on Assad now for a little bit. You mentioned minority groups in Syria. I know there's a Christian minority group there. I know there are others. How were they treated under Assad? And you mentioned he had a 50-year brutal regime. Talk about that and what was up with the minorities there.
No, they were quite brutal as well. And that's where we have to not be looking for any green shoots here, because nobody is on the good side. And so Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father, came into power right around 1972. So this has been going on for about 54 years, and 71, 72, so 53, 54 years. Math isn't my strong suit, but you see what I mean. They've had repeated chemical weapons strikes on minorities in their country. Your listeners might remember there were two strikes during the Trump administration in April of 17 and April of 18, which were so horrific, so many children killed, that President Trump ordered military retaliation for this in 17 unilaterally. In 18, we had British and French support. But this is really, you know, absolutely abhorrent behavior. They also pursued nuclear weapons, which the Israelis took out about 20 years ago. So this is just a very, very bad dictatorship, which has been the hostile enemy of Israel. They've attacked Israel many times, fought wars against Israel. They are responsible for attacks on American citizens. So absolutely nothing really redeemable about the Assads.
Okay, so if they hate Israel and they've attacked Israel, and anyone even vaguely familiar with that region knows they have done so, why such an opposition to them? Clearly the opposition was significant and widespread. If they were able to topple it, what's Al-Qaeda and ISIS's problem with them?
No, Al-Qaeda and ISIS don't like them because they are so-called Alawites, which is a sect of Islam that the Sunni extremists like Al-Qaeda and ISIS consider heretical. So they want to get rid of them on that grounds, that they are not pure enough in their Islam. And as I said, the Assad stayed in power by brutally repressing everybody who disagreed with them. So they've been on the wrong side of that for five decades now. So a lot of people hate them. And maybe 12 years ago, at the beginning of the Syrian civil war, some of the rebels were not entirely infected with this. But if you remember, President Obama allowed the situation to fester, kept drawing red lines and then not doing anything when people crossed over them. And then in 2015, we had the spectacle of him saying, oh, ISIS is just Al-Qaeda JV. And then suddenly ISIS was raging across Syria and Iraq, establishing the largest caliphate since the Middle Ages and beheading American journalists on video, among other atrocities. And, you know, we had to go back into Iraq at that point to get rid of these people. And that's who now we have emerging in Syria. So this has to be watched extremely closely, and primarily so it doesn't spill over into Israel.
Okay, tell me about these Kurdish forces, Victoria. I know they have a bunch of ISIS prisoners from that horrible fighting before. Are these Kurdish forces? I know Turkey is not thrilled about them. What's their status? Who are they? Friends? Enemies? Are they in deep trouble right now?
Again, we're going to embrace the and there. There are a number of different kinds of Kurds scattered across this region. We have the Iraqi Kurds in Kurdistan who have been great and good allies to the United States. You could say a lot better allies than we find in Baghdad, for example. Really good partners. In northeastern Syria, you have a range of folks. We have the Syria Defense Forces, the SDF, which have been, since the Obama era, our partners in that region. Yes, they have fought bravely against ISIS, have done some sort of questionable things of their own, but of course everyone in the region, in this region largely has. And as you said, they're guarding about 30,000 ISIS militants no one will take. These are the worst of the worst. There are women and children in this group, and literally none of their home countries will take them back. They're so thoroughly radicalized. And the SDF, with the support of about 900 American troops, are the ones who are guarding them and keeping the situation more or less under control. What complicates this further is President Erdogan of Turkey, of course, on the northern border of this region, considers pretty much every Turk a terrorist. There is this PKK group, which are particularly militant against Turkey, that he hates most specifically, but pretty much all Kurds are anathema to Erdogan. And so in a way, you could say the Obama era policy had failure baked in from the outset, because like it or not, Turkey is a fellow member of NATO. Turkey has the largest military in Europe. Do I agree with their current leadership? No. And do I agree with what they're doing now? No. But, you know, this was always going to come to a head. Turkey was always going to win this battle. And we've chosen to create this untenable situation, as I said, primarily as the policy of President Obama. So again, it's extremely complicated and murky, and there really aren't that many white knights here.
Man, there certainly aren't. Okay, finally, I swear this is my last one. What's their problem with Saudi Arabia? You said they're all Sunni. I don't understand.
Well, there is this sect of radical Islam who consider the House of Saud the illegitimate keeper of the two mosques, the two holiest sites of Islam in Mecca and Medina, and that they want to dominate those. And so they have also been hostile to our traditional Gulf partners and allies, Saudi Arabia, UAE, for example, Bahrain. Even though they are Sunni, they are considered way too moderate for these jihadist extremists. And so they want to take over these holy sites. And remember, the third holiest site in Islam is Jerusalem. And so first they want to come for the mosques, and then they want to come for Jerusalem, because the added benefit of Jerusalem is they would get to kill a whole lot of Jews, which is their other favorite pursuit. So this is an interesting scenario, though, because it makes the case for why a peace deal, an accord, or a normalization deal, if you will, between Saudi Arabia and Israel makes so much sense. They're facing a common enemy here, which is also the enemy of the United States. It's the same kind of scenario where they're the little Satan and we're the big Satan.
Yeah, no doubt. Victoria, thank you so much. That was wonderful. Appreciate it. I'm so much smarter now. I'm going to take so much of that information and tell all my friends and not give Victoria any credit and just act like I'm a Syrian expert, I highly suggest you do the same. Now, maybe your mind isn't ready to do that yet. That's because you haven't been taking your chalk. Have you been taking your chalk? Every day, I never miss a day. Every single day I wake up, I eat my breakfast, and I take my male vitality stack from chalk. Or your female vitality stack. Maybe you're just gonna have chocolate powder with your breakfast, but you need some natural herbal supplements in your life. It'll change your life and make the whole thing better. Your energy levels, it just, you can't imagine what this stuff does for your mind. And it's natural. Stop putting things in your body that wreck your body. Go to Chalk First. They have something for everyone, and they have huge discounts on subscriptions. It's Christmas time, after all. Chalk.com/JesseTV. Go enjoy. We'll be back. All right, let's start catching up on some culture war stuff, because that's nothing we're ever going to set aside on this show, as much as we care about dollars and cents. None of that matters if we turn into Sodom and Gomorrah, which we are well on our way. Joining me now, D.C. correspondent for The Daily Wire, does a great job, Mary Margaret Olihan. Mary, okay, first of all, this Supreme Court hearing with the child tranny stuff in Tennessee and things like that. I know you wrote that wonderful book, D-Trans. Are you, what kind of a feeling did you get from that? Are they going to uphold this law?
No, I don't think, well, yes, I think they are. What we heard from the justices last week is that they seem very predisposed to uphold Tennessee's law protecting kids from these transgender procedures. Based on everything they were saying, of course, we can't totally predict, and we won't have a decision until spring or maybe early June, but it's looking good for Tennessee and for the legislation that they enacted here to protect kids.
Mary, nationally, everyone has a different perspective on things. You're more all over this stuff than I am. It feels like maybe we reached peak tranny at some point in time here, and that now officially the tide is pushing back the other way. I'm sure I didn't put that as delicately as you would have, but have we reached peak tranny?
Jesse, you might be right on that one. I mean, especially after the 2024 election, we did this massive story here at Daily Wire about how the Trump campaign really leaned into the transgender issues, especially in some of their ads where they pointed out that, you know, Kamala is for they, them, President Trump is for you, or they pointed out that Kamala supports taxpayer-funded transgender surgeries for illegal immigrants, just insane things like that that the American people listened to and thought, what? That's absurd. And I think at the end of the day, we know that a lot of people went to the polls specifically on the trans issues and voted Trump into office specifically because of that, the 2024 sleeper issue. So I would argue that the tide is indeed turning on this topic. I think that more and more Americans are just pushing back on this radical craziness when it comes to men and women's spaces, when it comes to transgender procedures for kids. And Trump has seen this. He's leaned into that messaging. His most effective ad was the one that I just mentioned, the one highlighting Kamala's extremism. And I think that's very indicative of where our culture's at, but also all these detransitioner lawsuits, the legislation all over the country protecting kids from these types of things. All of this to me is a sign that yes, the tide is turning.
Mary, now, none of the information that's come out recently has been news to you or me or really anybody probably watching us right now on television. So what is it about the general public? Are they just now finding out? Is that what it is? Is it that you and me were in a bubble here and everyone watching and the general public just didn't realize how pervasive this stuff was? Because this stuff's been going on for a few years now.
It's true. It has been going on for several years. But I think part of the problem is that our legacy media is complicit in all of this. Our legacy media uses the terminology of the left to obscure what's actually going on. So, for example, they say gender-affirming care when what they should say is transgender surgeries, hormones, and puberty blockers, even for kids. But they purposefully use these euphemisms because these leftist orgs have told them to help them to promote these types of things. And that sounds crazy and conspiratorial, but anytime you take a look at CNN, Associated Press, and let me know if they're talking about gender-affirming care, because most Americans won't really know what that story is about because it's so purposefully deceitful. Whereas if you read the Daily Wire, we call it what it is. We call it transgender surgeries, hormones, and puberty blockers. We're not going to hide any of that. We're going to set the truth out there and let people decide. And I think many conservative outlets have done this in recent months, and it's really helped shine a light on this topic. Conservative commentators as well, people like you just speaking the truth, you know, being funny like you just were about the topic and helping people understand this is crazy. This is not something that people are aligned with, and we got to put a stop to it.
Mary, there's plenty of demonic evil crap going on when it comes to this kind of stuff, but I don't think a lot of people are aware of how intimately involved Big Pharma is in this. I know in my state of Texas, we just recently had some training activism because of a law here. Some people did some really good journalism and dug into it and found out Big Pharma was funding it all. All those turbo freaks in the streets with their leather chaps and crap like that on, it was all Big Pharma money. It's Big Pharma who wants these customers who are gonna need God knows how many pills and therapy for the rest of their lives because they chopped right. their penis off.
Right, people don't realize how long-term these procedures are. When you think about it, let's say your son wants to become a woman and he starts taking estrogen. He doesn't just take estrogen for a week. He takes it for the rest of his life if he's trying to be a woman for the rest of his life. And that's crazy. That's bills upon bills upon bills. That's so much hormones in his body that should not be there. Same thing for girls. They're pumping themselves full of testosterone for the rest of their foreseeable life. So this is bills for a very long time, and it is a profitable endeavor for Big Pharma. But I think the reckoning is coming. You know, you look at these detransitioner lawsuits, and you see they're suing the hospitals, they're suing the medical providers, they're suing the therapists and the teachers and the doctors. Everybody is going to have their comeuppance. And there was a massive lawsuit last week on a trans doctor who's one of the most high-profile ones. She's considered the gold standard of doctors. She is being sued for medical negligence because she pushed this child down this path when she was only 14 years old. Okayed that girl for a double mastectomy.
Oh, that is so freaking unimaginably sad. Okay, let's change to something else. Again, you should really go pick up Mary's book, Detrans, if you want to get a little bit more boned up on this stuff. Abortion. Of course, the right loves to run away from this issue now because we feel like we've lost it. But where are we on it? Roe versus Wade getting overturned was wonderful. This is not something we can just simply dance away from, though, because babies are still being massacred by the million. Right. Where are we at on it?
Well, Jesse, I always love talking about this topic with you because you're not afraid to call it like it is. I think post-Dobbs, what we're seeing across the country is states trying to enact protections to protect babies from from abortion. But we've seen so much misinformation, especially during the election cycle. Of course, Kamala Harris's campaign knew that this was their shoe-in. The more they promoted this abortion misinformation, the more likely people were, especially young women, to vote for Kamala based on abortion. And so they planted stories all over the country and they promoted stories all over the country that spread misinformation, such as, pro-life laws are causing women to have to miscarry their babies, or pro-life laws are causing women, if they do miscarry their babies, to not be able to receive necessary care. That's a lie, obviously, and some states like Florida have done a really good job in combating that misinformation. But unfortunately, different places have not been so effective, and so there are many confused women. And I think what I've seen from the pro-life movement is efforts to be really clear, to say, no, this pro-life law protects women. It's here to protect women, to protect babies. You're not going to get denied miscarriage care. In fact, you do need that care. You shouldn't be afraid to go to the doctor. So I think pro-lifers are really focusing on that right now, messaging saying, we support the mom, we support the baby, we want to be there for both of you. And there's a lot of pushback right now and trying to get that message across.
Mary, as always, outstanding work. Come back soon. Thank you for what you do. All right, so we're going to do something a little bit different here. David Pollack is going to join us, former, you know, college football standout. I remember watching David Pollack play, NFL's big sports guy. He's got let's talk about some family stuff. And I'm also going to start yelling and screaming about this stupid college football playoff. Everyone disagrees with me on it. I'm pitching a fit, and I'm going to pitch a fit to David Pollack about it next and see what he has to say. Maybe he'll argue with me. I don't have any idea. Before we get to him, let me talk to you about the fight for babies. We just talked about it. What do we do? How do we save them? Because overturning Roe was great. I'm glad it happened, but that doesn't change hearts. doesn't change minds. How do we change a pro-abortion culture? Well, ultrasound. Ultrasound is the tool that has saved more lives than anything else, because once a young woman hears that heartbeat, it's not a clump of cells anymore. She's a mom. Now she's a mom. That's what preborn does. They give free ultrasounds to women who are about to have abortions. And if preborn can pull it off, if they can get them in there and just get them the ultrasound, the women will choose life almost every time. Did you know that? At $28 you give to preborn, it's not nothing. You just bought a life, most likely. Someone will live because of you. $28. But whatever you give them is tax deductible. You can give them $28,000 for all I care. Preborn.com/Jesse. There is a life you have to save. We'll be back. All right, I'm excited about this. A little bit of a side turn for us, because I do some sports from time to time, but not a bunch. But when you have a former round freaking pick on your show, you're going to talk a little bit of college sports, pro sports. Joining me now, David Pollack, hosts a wonderful podcast now called Family Goals and has a book out, which we will get to, called The Kid Won't Quit. But I remember watching this guy commit murder on Saturdays at Georgia, and now he's joining us now here on I'm Right. All right, David, let's talk just briefly. We'll get to the NFL and NIL and college football and all this stuff like that, but I want to get to this book because I really love that people are starting to write children's books and books in general that promote our values. I've seen so much garbage raising my sons out there. How do you teach a kid, you know, hard work and things like that? There are finally books like that out there now, and it blesses me.
Well, that's great to hear. And that's what we've seen a little bit. I mean, obviously I have two kids, and like teaching them how to compete and teaching them perspective is not the easiest thing in the world. And I think we read a study too going into this, like 60% of kids that play sports quit by the age of 13. And that's a lot, man. That's high, because football and sports teach you so much about yourself and discipline and toughness and how to win, how to work together. And so that's why we wrote it. And it's called The Won't Quit Kid, teaching kids that it's not about like being the star. It's not about making plays. It's not about home runs and touchdowns. Like, it's about every day trying to come bring your best and be the best version of you. And guess what? It's going to be really hard, and it's going to hurt, and it's going to be hot. And you're going to have those things throughout your life. So it's kind of a cool message of using sport to teach kids that, and for them to do their best and realize that that's good enough.
David, my wife asked me one time where I got my confidence from, and it's funny you just brought that up. I told her, and I don't know that I'm right about this or that you would agree, but that there's not a second way to get confident than by going through hard things, whether it was, you know, sports or Marine Corps or whatever it may be, that at least for dudes, I can't speak for women, doesn't matter how many times you tell them you're proud of them, you love them, all this other stuff, unless something hurts and is difficult, you can't be that confident, that's where it comes from. You agree with that?
Dude, you got to fail. I mean, if you never fail, that means you've never pushed yourself to do anything great. Like, that means you've always taken it where it's easy. So, yeah, I do. Man, it's crazy, Jesse. I have two kids, and my daughter, she was born with confidence. Plenty of her daddy's confidence / arrogance. And then I have a son who was built just like mommy. And you know, it's funny because my biggest goal in life was not to raise, you know, confident athletes. My biggest goal was to raise great Christian kids that put other people first and served other people first. And so I didn't really build confidence. That wasn't the thing I was trying to do. I was trying to get them to learn how to build up others and be a great teammate. And so what I've really learned, man, is I've got to do a really good job with my son pouring into him and building his confidence. And I tell him all the time, man, like, God made you for something great, dude. Like, I watch you play and I love it. And but I don't talk about the plays he made, but I just talk about how much I love watching him compete and watching him play, and just keep reaffirming, man, that like, God's got an awesome plan for your life and he's going to do amazing things. And I've learned as a parent that, you know, not each kid is the same, and we've got to parent them differently for sure. And I've definitely learned with my son, man, I got to pour into that confidence bucket more than I do with my daughter.
It's interesting. And I'll tell you, there's just no greater time, at least there was none for me, than when my second son got baptized. First one had already knocked it out. Once the second son did it, I said, God, you can just take me home now. I'm done. I'm a happy man. Take me home at 43. That was all I needed to see in life.
That's all. That is great perspective. And what if we all had that perspective, man? Like, what if we all led our family from the standpoint of, like, I am more concerned about where they go when they die than I am about sports. I am about school. Like, I think we would offer so much more grace, and we would be so much of a better representation for them as a man going forward. And so, yeah, I remember celebrating. I baptized my son, and I remember celebrating. I was like, listen, this is the most proud moment I've ever had. Like, I'm not – all that stuff you do everywhere else is cool, man, and that's great. But, like, the commitment you're making right now for the rest of your life is something that I'm so excited to walk out with you. And I'm so excited that you made it, that you did it. So I think you're right, man. We got to pour into them. We got to realize so many people missing church every Sunday for sport. I'm like, we got to get this figured out, man. Like, sport is not that important. Sport is awesome. It's great, but it can't be everything. And we see so much of that now. And we got to get our kids focused on the main thing, that's for sure.
It's The Won't Quit Kid. Highly recommend people pick up. It's both of mine. I'm a happy man. All right, I have to yell about something, David. I hate the NIL, and I hate the stupid college football playoff. Look, I'm an Ohio State fan. Don't yell at me. I'm an Ohio State fan. I was born in Ohio, and we lost to Michigan, you know, last week. And for an Ohio State fan, that's supposed to be devastating, like the end of the world, right? And I was bummed. But it wasn't the end of the world because I knew we were getting in anyway. That should have ended our season. But now, because of the stupid playoff, the stakes aren't as high. I freaking hate it.
Are the stakes higher, Jesse? I mean, we were told, Jesse, that this was going to devalue the regular season. Did it devalue the regular season? Or do we have more teams with a chance to crack at the apple at the end?
Okay, I don't disagree, but I say it did devalue the regular season because while I was bummed after we lost to Michigan, you never want to lose to Michigan, especially a crappy Michigan team, when you know you still might be hoisting up the national championship title, a trophy at the end of the year, it's not as devastating. I guess that's my point. You've taken at least some of the stakes out of the regular season. That's my complaint.
I can get down with that, but here's the thing, Jesse, and listen, you're an Ohio State fan, and I'm a Georgia guy, so we don't have to worry about it as much because our teams are always pretty dang good. But here's the thing that's cool. Indiana's in the playoffs. SMU's in the playoffs. Like, Boise State is in the playoffs. Like, that is so cool. Arizona State is in the playoffs. Those are four teams that never have a chance to get there. And because of NIL, because of these kids in the transfer portal, the talent goes all over the country now. It doesn't go to Ohio State and Georgia and Alabama because you know what the recruiting pitch for those teams used to be? Come here. I know you'll sit on the bench for your first year, maybe your first 2 years, but we will develop you and put you in the NFL and make you a lot of money. Now everybody's like, wait a minute, I can go over there and I can go make a lot of money. I don't have to worry about sitting on the bench at Ohio State or Georgia or Alabama. So I think parity is here to stay. I think you're one transfer portal team away from Indiana, FSU a year ago. Like, now I think you can rebuild faster than ever, and it kind of changes the landscape, and we have more parity than we ever have.
Oh, imagine you losing a prize player to Indiana. Oh, gosh. David Pollack, the kid, go pick up his book. Appreciate you very much, sir. All right. We have Light in the Move. Next. All right, it is time to lighten the mood. And there's nothing that does my heart well than playing lighten the mood videos that bring trauma to people. So, without further ado, enjoy.
Yeah.
And that's why you don't ever let Dad dress up as the Grinch, because he's going to take it too far. I'll see you tomorrow.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.